Well, I'm here to confess a guilty secret. Nothing very exciting or titillating, just a general clergy dirty secret. Clergy have an ambivalent relationship with the great religious holidays and holy days of all of our calendars, whether it's Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain. These holidays keep coming around every year. And we keep going, what am I going to say that's new? How can I approach Christmas in a way that's never been approached before? And if I find that way, I can tell you, it would be a tragic error. We're always looking to be innovative and entertaining and not repeat that sermon from last year, although the one from 2 years ago is probably pretty safe because you're not quite sure where you heard it. And it's true of all of the holidays and all of the holy days. And there are two things that pull against each other. Clergy wants to be creative. Really, we do. All of us. Music directors want to be creative. Really, all of them. And we are torn between this innovation versus war horses. Are we going to sing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas or Have Yourself a Sondheim kind of Christmas in 12 Town? And the arts department wants to go arty, and the people want to go somewhere else. And I completely get it. I love the holidays and holy days, despite their challenges, because I actually don't feel a challenge to do something really weird and strange. Because to me, when I think of those great occasions, what I want my memories played with. I want to think and feel about those holidays the way I did when I was young. I want to smell the smells. I want to hear the songs. I want that piece of continuity from past to present to future to ring inside of me. When I think about the great occasions of the liturgical calendar and being Unitarian Universalist, I think of all the great occasions of the liturgical calendar. When I think of Hanukkah, I smell latkes frying in chicken fat. When I think of Passover, I think of brisket. When I think of Christmas, I smell spiced wine. When I think of Easter, I do smell the ham. These are like à la recherche de temps perdu. These are the things that trigger in us memory that is deep, deep within the brain, deep within the heart. They're experiential, not intellectual. Understanding and taking a new approach to holidays is fine. Learning something is fine. But it's evolutionary for most of us. I remember going to very cutting-edge Christmas services and not being particularly nourished by them. I remember going to cutting-edge Passover seders. I have been to a humanist seder from which God was banished, which makes the story a little bit awkward. I'll get back to that. I've been to feminist seders. I've been to politically active seders. I've been to gender-neutral seders. I've been to all of them, and they were all uniquely unfulfilling. And yet, every one of those has left an imprint on the seder that I conduct today. Everyone, I have taken the parts, the nourishment of all of those experiences and evolved something in real time for me that calls upon the past. That's what we try to do with our Christmas Eve service here on, of all times, Christmas Eve. We try to move the story ahead, but not abandon its roots, to understand part of where we're going from where we have been, and to pick and to choose. Unitarian Universalists do what everybody does, but we celebrate it, and that is we are cafeteria people. We do not serve out the same meal and expect everybody to get nourishment from everything. We do not serve a meal of spiritual gruel because we don't want to offend anybody because our theology might be different from yours. We want to be who we are so that we can pick and choose. Here, as I said in the opening words, or the welcome, attentively and generously what other people get for their spiritual nourishment. And that's why I love to celebrate the holidays. It is a Passover in the beginning for Christians of Holy Week. These two things are not unrelated. There's a reason that the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. And they tell stories that are universal in their nature and are deeper, much deeper than the simple questions that people ask so often. The simple question of, well, did it happen? Did Moses lead the Israelites out of Egypt land, spend 40 years in the desert because he wouldn't ask directions that should have taken tops 10 days? Did 600,000 people, as the Bible accounts somewhat generously, spend 40 years bivouacking on the Sinai? And the answer historically is almost certainly no. Archaeologists cannot find the detritus of civilization. 600,000 people spending 40 years on the desert, you would find a Slurpee cup. There would be a Coke can, some M&M wrappers, a couple of Slim Jim things. People leave traces, even that the desert can't cover up. The story, whether it is Passover or whether it's Holy Week of Palm Sunday to Good Friday and Easter, is not about simply did it happen. That's a legitimate historic question, but it's not really the religious question. It is, what do I get from it? What can I get from it? Where's the nourishment? These stories are not at all simple-minded. They are rich and deep and complex. The Passover story, I'm sure you all know, when Israel was in Egypt land, let my people go. They worked so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Slavery is not fun. We know this. It wasn't fun then, it's not fun now. There's physical slavery, and it still exists today. There's economic slavery. There's slavery of oppression, of not having full citizenship and full rights. There are all kinds of ways that we trap and restrict human beings, and it is not good. The story of Passover is a story of hope. It's a story of birth. It's a story of rebirth. At its simplest, most literal allegorical level, not a contradiction, at its most literal allegorical level, it's a story of a people living in slavery in the West, where the sun sets, it's a place of darkness, of slavery, of death, and a birth, a rebirth, through, yes, a wet canal, and in Hebrew it's Mitzrayim. It is a tight, squeezed place. The birth imagery is intentional, and they are born from darkness through a canal into the light, like most people are. And then they are taken care of. They are fed by unknown sources, maybe God. They are given manna from heaven. And manna does not mean bread, and it does not mean breadfruit. The root word of manna in Hebrew is, what is it? It's a question. And when the people first got it, they didn't say, oh goody, God has given us bounty. They said, what is it? This you call a meal? You got us out of Egypt, you parted the Red Sea, and this? I'm sorry, I have food issues. I can't handle manna. The people were not grateful. They complained bitterly, just like children do. And what did they do as soon as Daddy left and went up to the hills for a little conversation, they put a sign down on the boulevard saying "Party," and we're going to build an altar out of melted gold, and we're going to worship an idol. And then Daddy got home, and he waxed wroth, and then Roth waxed Moses, and then he broke the tablet. And then he went back to Sinai for another 40 days. Incidentally, spending 40 days at Sinai here would be very expensive. He had a good HMO. And so he comes back, gives the people the law again, and they say, okay, fine. And they continue the journey. And then they find partners. They get married. They have children. And they come to another river that they can't cross over. It's the story, but their children can't. The people who left Egypt did not live to inhabit the promised land. And it was, as you know, back from the biblical story, and as you know from the headlines this week, it has not been milk and honey and peace in the promised land, because it got promised to a lot of people. They're still fighting over that. And we human beings are still fighting over that. So it's not an end of a story. It's an end of a generation when we look at the story. The same thing is true in terms of Holy Week. You're looking at the rhythm of a life, and you're looking at the rhythm of life itself. Jesus goes into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday and is welcomed with hosannas and, yay, good to see you. And through the course of the week, there are celebrations, there are parties, there's preaching, there is living, there's living with friends, with disciples, and also a sense of impending doom, a sense that an end is coming, a knowledge that there will be betrayal and rejection. And at the end of a life, at the end of every life, there is death. There is a sense of loneliness, of betrayal. One of the most poignant moments in all of the Gospels for me is when Jesus' penultimate words, quoted from the 22nd Psalm, "Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" The root word of forsaken is sabbathani. Why have you gone on sabbatical? Why did you take today off? Why are you not paying attention to what's going on with me right now? Because I am lonely and frightened and I feel abandoned. The great message that gets glossed over in traditional Christianity, which wants to see faith as something high and constant, is if Jesus can feel down in the dumps, if Jesus can feel alone and betrayed and disconnected, who are normal people not from time to time to go, oh God, what's it all about? Why do I feel like this? Why am I alone with my heartbeat at 3 o'clock in the morning worrying about this or that or the other thing? The gospel message is, that's normal. That's who we are. We are people who can celebrate, and we are people who can feel profoundly alone as well as intimately connected. They are all part of the rhythm of life, of love, and of relationship. The story of the Passover is not simply the story of the people, but when you think about it, it's the story of everyone. We are, most of us, conceived, if not literally, in darkness, maybe some candlelight and Johnny Mathis in the background, and then we are born, we are taken care of, we rebel, we get the law finally, we partner up, we go through our struggles of backsliding, of going left when we should have gone right, and right when we should have gone left. We imperfectly struggle our path across the Sinai, sometimes asking for directions and getting them wrong, sometimes stubbornly not asking for directions at all, and then we come to another river. In Judaism and in Christianity, that's usually symbolized by the Jordan. There is the river, there is the Red Sea that begins the journey through that canal, and then there is that Jordan River at the end that we don't cross over into, but our children do. And so the story of the Passover is a story of a people. It's a story of every person as we struggle to find out who we are, to find out how do we want to spend our time here in the light while we have it. It is a reminder that we are ultimately not alone. We are part of a longer journey, a longer voyage. We are anchored in time. We come from a place. Jews, Christians, and Muslims all begin that story and that journey in Egypt through that canal across that desert. And all are asked to ask the important question. What am I doing here? While the light shines, while I run my lap of this relay race and prepare to hand that baton off to another generation, what is my legacy going to be? What am I going to do? What am I going to build? What am I going to leave? Who am I going to be? Who am I going to clothe? Who am I going to comfort? What will be the instrument by which we choose to leave our mark on the geography, on the institutions, and in the hearts of the people with whom we share this journey? And I'm not speaking about simply the people in this room and in this congregation. We make this journey with a planet. With a planet that has really one ocean, one river, one water, one race, one humanity. We share this life on this journey for, in philosophers say, subspecie eternitatis, in view of eternity, for a very brief time. How do we make this brief time important? How do we reveal if we are essentialists or create, if we are existentialists, a sense of meaning? What will our mark be? We have tremendous freedom as individuals. Now I am speaking to the people in this room. As individuals, to make a difference in our world, to make a difference in each other's lives. We've heard about some of the difference that we make to each other as a community when we are in difficult times, when people are hurting and suffering and feel alone and abandoned. We make a difference to each other in good times when we have somebody to celebrate, someone to throw our arms around in joy at a happy occasion. We are in this together in a happy and intimate dance of life. While the sun shines on this beautiful day, and we have the power to be inspired by the day, to know how precious our time is, because there is a river that we will not be able to cross, a future that we will not live in with our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, but a future that we are instrumental in creating. I promised that this would be a fundraising sermon about the conversations that we're going to have. And let me say this to you directly. There was a man, I won't say in my congregation in Studio City, because he left before I got there. But every year, he wrote a really, really, really significant check. And I kept calling him up and wanting to take him out to lunch and meet him. I was very glad that he left before I got there, because if he left after we had met, I would have taken it personally. But I asked him, why are you doing this? He said, you know, there was a time when I felt very isolated and lonely, and there was something incomplete. And that congregation was there for me. Its building, its clergy, its programs, the various meetings that took place in the building. They were there and they enriched me. They nourished me. They gave me the strength to fight and claw my way back to life, to a second act, that was successful. And I'm not paying this money out of guilt. No. I'm writing these checks because I want this institution to be there for somebody else like me in my situation, because there are hundreds of us, there are thousands of us that need to find a place where they are accepted, where their individuality is celebrated and not repressed, where they are given the power and the honor to be taken for who they are and what they are, and embraced for their uniqueness and individuality. That was the legacy that he wanted to maintain. I'll tell you his name. He has passed away. His name is Robert Stubbs, and it's a name that should be remembered, because what he did was he made a list of his priorities, of what he wanted to do, what had meant something to him, what he wanted to leave to someone else. The theme that we're going to be having conversations about is, if this is casual and means nothing, for goodness sake, respond appropriately. If we make a difference in each other's lives, if we give each other hope and comfort, physical and spiritual sustenance, a place to be, to grow, and to share, we respond lovingly and responsibly to each other. Because this is not a charity. It's just because we're a 501c3 doesn't make us in line competing with all the other good causes in the world. We are a cooperative. Every part, every program is essential to what makes us unique. Not better than anyone else, but unique. Individuals who are taken and accepted in our individuality, and together we create something that is really very, very special. All people, all institutions, all religions have a life cycle. As the stories about Holy Week and Passover show, they're a large story and they're an individual story. So I want to close with a hallelujah that was so beautifully sung. How'd they ever memorize the words? I just don't understand. You know, this is a quick study choir. If you listen to the form of the music, it starts small, like a baby. It grows, and the crescendo that isn't in a straight line, but like growth itself. It goes up and down, but trending up, bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it ebbs. And then it comes down, it reaches out again, and then fades softly. It is a retelling of that part of the Exodus, the retelling of Holy Week. It's a retelling of our individual lives and the rhythms of our lives. If we look at religion only on the surface, did it happen or didn't it happen, we miss the music. And we come together in communities like this to hear the music, to sing the music, to share the music. We know that we take our individual voices in our different keys and pitches, in my case, different keys and pitches on the very same measure, and we join them together. And we can hear, if it's one or two people, maybe it's dissonant. But when 100 people are in the room, there is magic. It is harmony. We create a buzz and we self-correct. We find together the harmonies and create them and experience them. That is one of the many reasons that community is important. I know that there are lots of people in the world that say, I get what I need walking alone in the park. And I get a lot walking in the park and biking in the park. I get what I need alone listening to music, and I get a lot alone listening to music. But there is something that you don't get on the internet. There's something that you don't get on TV. There's something that you don't get in individual meditation. And that is the buzz of being together. Of hearing and feeling and seeing and sensing that we are in this life, in this community, in this sunlight, in this miracle together. And we need each other, and we acknowledge each other, and we celebrate each other and the happy chance of being together on this beautiful day.